Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga. Fangloy ang kalawana katulor ali fataga.
Welcome to the 165th of the Cthulhu Podcast. I'm FNH. Today we're starting off with the next part of the battalion history, and then we'll have a musical number. And we'll finish off with the final part of The Wrong Side of the Tracks by T.C. McQueen. Let's get started. Second phase. On the 15th of June, the battalion returned to hold the line which it had helped to hold and gain in April. Leaving Zusastra, it marched to support near camp near Henin Sir Cajul. There was practically no accommodation here, and ground sheets had to be used as shelters. The following day, it relieved the 10th Battalion Essex Regiment in the front line, just south of the Cajul River Valley, opposite Cherisy. After 4 days in this sector, it went out to Divisional Reserve near Bourselat-Aumont, where on the 27th of June, it was visited by Colonel the Honourable W. L. Vane, the Honorary Colonel of the battalion. A regular system of reliefs which lasted for 3 months now commenced. Under this system, the battalion had 2 periods of 4 days in the front line and 1 in support at Henin or Neuville Vitasse, followed by 8 days in reserve in camp near Mercatel. The weather was good on the whole, and the trenches in excellent condition. The enemy was only moderately active, and there were very few casualties. One of the battalion areas in this sector was the bank from which the attack started on the 14th of April, and whilst there, a cross was erected to the memory of those who fell on that day. As a result of their long stay here, the men became very familiar with the whole area, and their experiences in the communication trenches Foster Avenue, Shikar Lane, Kestrel Avenue, Avenue Trench and others were talked of for long after. Neither did they forget the lone sap from which the enemy captured 2 of their comrades, Cable Trench, which was raided by a party under 2nd Lieutenant B.R. Leatherbarrow, Concrete Trench, the Hindenburg Line, the caves in Marlière Village, which on one occasion produced some interesting souvenirs left by the Boches, and many other localities. Apart from minor raids and counter-raids, the only outstanding incident was the double raid of the 15th of September. This operation was carried out by the 9th Durham Light Infantry in the afternoon and repeated by the 8th Durham Light Infantry in the evening. The battalion was holding the sector immediately on the right of the raiders, and its function was to draw the enemy's attention and fire by the exhibition of dummy figures and a dummy tank, which were later on viewed at the United Services Museum in Whitehall. 2nd Lieutenant Leatherbarrow was in charge of these dummies, assisted by Sergeant P. Finn, who was awarded the Military Medal for his work. Other decorations earned during this period were military medals awarded to Corporal Nesbitt and Private Allison of X Company for digging out a man buried by shellfire under very dangerous conditions. Apart from good work in the line, not only in patrolling etc., but also in improving the trenches till they were probably as good as any on the whole front, considerable work was done on the erection of reserve camps, the Northumberland Lines, a very comfortable hut camp near Mercatel. The men heard that they were to leave the area before winter. Early in October, they marched to a canvas camp at Gommé Court, just off the main Bapume Road, and stayed there for a short time training. The arrival of representatives from divisions in the salient to instruct in the methods adopted in the recent successful fighting there, left no doubts as to the next move. Today's music is by Edwin McKennelly. Recorded in 1926, this is called Moonlight in Mandalay. Thank you.
I've taken you from my sight, till you're with me every night in dreams. My rose of Mandalay, don't stay so far away. Why should we two be apart? Come bloom again in my heart, it's moonlight in Mandalay.
To today's main feature. This is the final part of The Wrong Side of the Tracks by T.C. McQueen. Chapter 12. Ouroboros. I came to in the back of an ambulance with a medic shining a torch into my eyes. I batted his hands away and sat up. "So you made it out then," said a familiar voice. The doc's beaming face swam into focus. He slapped me on the shoulder, turning his head so I wouldn't see him palm a tear from his eye. "You had us worried for a moment there. When the engine didn't follow the express through, I assumed something bad had gone wrong." He pushed up his glasses to rub at his eyes again. I looked at my watch before realizing the folly of it. "The bug blew up the engine and killed the kid. I couldn't stop him." I let out a long breath. "What became of our extraterrestrial friend, may I ask?" he asked as I sat upright, popping a couple of painkillers the doc handed me. "Oh, he ran into some townsfolk. They showed him some Seward's Ridge hospitality." I smiled weakly. I gestured past him at the train surrounded by a sea of first responders and bathed in flashing lights. "The passengers, they okay?" He nodded. "Special Agent Herriot's bravery saved almost 300 lives, John, including my own. The passengers all awoke the moment the train pierced the barrier. For the life of me, I can't figure out why. Most are off to hospital, no serious issues, mercifully." The doc helped me down from the ambulance. An area the size of 3 football pitches was surrounded in police barriers, patrolled by armed marines, some in full respirators and chemical suits. "Doc, what's with the circus? How long behind you was I?" "It was nearly 2 hours before you showed up, John," came a voice from behind me. I turned to come face to face with Septimus White, the director himself. I was honoured. He towered over me at 6'2", rake-thin, with jet black hair slicked back as always. His strong features set off his dark suit and overcoat. "You always did like an entrance," he grinned, before hugging me like the brother he was to me. "Sorry for the fuss, but when a train materializes out of thin air and onto the busiest commuter track on the East Coast, people notice. Phone calls get made. We're calling it a chemical spill. Amtrak are furious. You know how it is." He drew a long look. "I almost forgot to thank you for returning government property." "Huh?" I replied. "Special Agent Herriot's Dodge. You did inspect the contents." He fixed me with the gaze he must have used when he was a miskatonic professor back in the day. The gaze that said, "You better know an answer, pal, or it's your ass." I hated it when he did that. I had other things on my mind, Septimus. Ancient monsters, alien bugs, town full of zombies. You know how it is. The sarcasm didn't go down well. I was, of course, referring to the box of files in the trunk. Marcus tells me Agent Herriot was transporting them for Mr. Hagen. I suggest you take a look. He led the way through the bustle of firemen, cops and paramedics to a large blue tent, discreetly guarded by several large men in suits. They nodded to Septimus and swept the door open for him. Inside, harsh lighting hung above a table with several familiar items, including the remnants of the Dodge's armory, the small and large hall passes, and lastly, a box of files that I had so consistently ignored. "How's your Japanese, Marcus?" asked Septimus, passing him a slim folder from the box. "To my eternal shame, a little rusty," he confessed, adjusting his glasses. He pored over the file in near silence. And when I say near silence, I mean he uttered the occasional, "Oh my lord," or "unbelievable." Abruptly, he slammed the document down, turning to face me and Septimus, his face pale. "Do you know what this means?" he croaked. I turned to Septimus, who merely nodded solemnly. "Damn academics," I held my hands up in mock surrender. "Doc, it's been a long, crappy day. Why not cut a guy a break, huh?" "Oh, of course, sorry." He took a long breath, which was my cue to grab a nearby plastic seat and fish through my pockets for my flask. Much to my disgust, it was still empty. "These documents are marked with the symbol for the Imperial Japanese Military Intelligence, in particular, the Spirits of the Ancestors program." He paused as my brain wheels started to turn. "SOTA. Yeah, Japanese sorcerers from the war. Mean too, as I remember." At that, I got a whiff of cologne and a small shape swept up to Septimus with a tray of coffee. "Director, your coffee," cooed the troll. I couldn't resist waving him over, snatching up a cup of Joe. I gave him my best smile. "Thanks, Agent Troll. Tollan, right?" His gaze spoke of disgust and hatred. Septimus dismissed him with a gesture. I waved him bye-bye as he stomped out, glowering over his shoulder at me. "Sorry, Doc, you were saying?" I took a grateful sip of the hot drink. I could feel the caffeine firing off synapses long inactive. "Anyway," he continued, "these files were recovered from a temple complex near Osaka, late 1945. They detail travel orders made for the 10th of August that year for a named VIP and his entourage. A captured Dutch merchant ship was used to evacuate personnel and material towards China." I didn't like where this was going. "Septimus, if the doc is right, that was after you had Truman nuke two cities to kill you-know-who?" He only nodded in reply. "He is clearly named in the orders, John. Tamashi Tabiru." He turned the file towards me, perhaps forgetting he was talking to someone who struggled to read his own handwriting. A cold feeling crept into my chest and gripped my heart. "What did you say?" I whispered. "His name, John. Tamashi Tabiru. Regularly speaking, he who gorges himself on souls. Soul Eater." "Damn, Septimus. The report I made about vampires in Boston. The one who penetrated DHS? He called his boss, Tamashi Tabiru. I knew that name was familiar. The son of a... He's alive." "John," Septimus interrupted my departure. "That information hasn't reached me yet. Let me make a call." He drew a cell phone from his coat and stepped away, barking orders at the poor soul on the other end. He snapped the phone shut, stepping back to the table. "John, why were you both on that train?" His eyes betrayed his concern, and he kept it from his voice. "You sent me a text the night I called in the vampire attacks, telling me to get the doc and travel to New York. You specifically said use the train." His concern was catching. Now I was concerned too. "John, your call came in this evening. I haven't sent you any such text. What's going on here?" He grabbed a passing suit. "Get Professor Bayliss in here now." "Septimus," I asked, "what day is it?" I shut my eyes, dreading the answer. "Tuesday?" He frowned at me, then glanced at his watch. "Nearly 10 p.m. I stuck out my hand. Give me your cell phone. He obliged, still frowning. I scrolled down to my number and sent, Git Marcus, take Boston train to New York City. Hurry. The gangly figure of Professor Lawrence Harold Bayliss stumbled over the threshold as Septimus reclaimed his cell from me. He grinned broadly at the sight of the doc and myself. After a raft of handshakes and backslapping, his eyes were drawn to the hypnotic swirls of the hall passes. He cradled the smaller hall pass in his arms like a child. I could see his mind reeling at the possibilities of fresh MIGO tech to play with. Hey, Bayliss, I addressed my old friend. Take a seat while I tell you all about time travel. I'm afraid that will have to wait, John. I'm restoring you to active duty with immediate effect. No more hiding in basements. He smiled grimly. Okay, so now what? Am I heading to Boston to look for the Soul Eater? I asked, standing to leave. Not exactly. We need to bring in a specialist in the subject. I happen to know exactly where you can find one. Again, the smile. That always made me nervous. A specialist? Where the hell will you find one of those? He kept smiling, and then the penny dropped. A pilot of our mutual acquaintance, who is currently residing in certain federal prison in Virginia? I'll call ahead. Let them know you're coming. He raised his cell phone to his ear. Luther Hagen. Crap. Well, that's it for today. Except to mention that my audiobook of Lovecraft's The Dunwich Horror is available to purchase now. Point your browser at britishaudiobooks.blogspot.com and you'll find details there. The opening music was provided by Victor Valdez from The Symbol Project, and this file is released on an attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk